Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under the Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course. To the Carpcast, introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chops. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie. Ooh,
so hello and welcome to episode 55 of the Carpcast. Rocking these out now, Mark, mid-50s, where we plan to keep firing all the way till next year. So how are you?
Oh, fabulous. Oh, mid-50, I'm feeling my age. How are you? You're a year older. Yeah, you're older than me, but yeah, mid-50, it's... we'll not talk about fish weights because I've never had a 55 or anything close, and you just start showing off, so we'll skip that bit.
Yeah.
But as I says, we're rocking, we're back on track, we've both been interviewing, and all the interviewees are down and recorded for the next glut of extras, which will be, as soon as we get our bit sorted and recorded and edited, there will be... Released, they'll be like London buses.
Yes, they'll be coming out one after the other. I recorded Jacko, Lee Jackson, today. He's going to be on the main Carpcast next week. I also recorded Mike Wilmot, who is on this week's Carpcast. He's our special guest for today. And you've done a few as well, haven't you, Mark?
I'll tell you one thing, it's not done yet, but on Wednesday, I'm actually visiting Julian Cundiff on his syndicate. I'll be taking the recording equipment down, so if anybody's got any questions they'd like me to put to Jules, or random points, or hair care tips, just post it on our Facebook page, and we'll have a laugh.
And who are the rest of the extra guests you've recorded?
The extra guests, we've got Ian McMillan, Ian Russell, Ian Chilcott, all the Ians in there, plus Adam Penning, Steve Briggs, to go with Lee Jackson, that we already mentioned, and that is
it's a fantastic lineup.
Yeah, most of that. Well, all of those have forgotten more about carp fishing than we'll ever know. There's a wealth of knowledge there.
I've just recorded Jacko today, actually, and it was a great old school chat, which you'll hear next week. But one of the striking things was, he caught a 24 pounder, which was a huge fish for the time. The same year I was born, when he was catching good 20s. no spoilers on that one, though. You can hear that on next week's Carpcast. As we said, we got Mike Wilmot on this week's Carpcast. He was a fantastic guest, all-round lovely guy, and he'll be coming up in a little bit. So, yeah, plenty of Carpcast content on the way. If you want to subscribe to The Extra, you can do so on our website, www.thecarpcast.com. You can make an account there and upgrade it so you get all the extra content. There's our previous pack of extra stuff on there, which is... it was a who's who of carp fishing again. There was Kevin Nash, Alan Blair, Frank Warwick, Ronnie De Grota, Daryl Peck,
John McAllister.
And John McAllister, yeah, all telling stories. There's no adverts on there. There's no no us waffling about the news. It's all either entertainment, story, or educational content on there. They're all at least 2 hours long. And you can buy the pack of the previous anglers on our website. As you can buy merchandise, clothing, and all sorts of other stuff to support the show. And the new lot will start to get released over the next week or two. And we'll catch up and get back on track for those that have subscribed yearly. You can buy them in individual packs for that group of anglers, or you can subscribe for only £35 for a year. and you can get all of them. So any fishing this week, Mark?
As soon as we finish recording, my van's already loaded, so I'll have to apologise already if I sound a bit rushed. But the weather outside is mint. As I was driving home from work this afternoon, I was on the phone to Ed Betteridge, who I'm sure you've seen. He's had a 49-pounder this afternoon. I'm itching to go. I'm chomping at the bit.
So as we record this, it's Sunday the 4th, and it's the back end of a new moon weekend, and there has been a definite upturn in fish this week. I've seen a lot of decent fish caught. The Scott Lloyd's brother, who we had on an earlier show, he's still, I think it's Neil Lloyd, he's fishing Stone Acres, and I noticed he had the number 9 bus, one of the finest carp in that lake. He's had that this weekend.
Oh, that is a stunner.
Eric's Willows, there's rumours of a 60-pounder. I don't know if you've heard those, Mark, but the big one's been out of there, and the rumour is it's 60-pound. Have you heard that one?
I've heard it's been out. I've not heard the weight yet, so I would bait a breath, because that will be the weekly Willows Whacker, no doubt.
Yes, I've heard it's been 60 pound. That is unconfirmed, but there's a lot of people heard the fish has been out, and it's due to go that sort of weight. What a lake that's turning into. And literally everywhere I've looked on Facebook this weekend, there's been a big fish. A friend I went to Lake Bled with this year, who had a fantastic time on Bled, Matty Lightfoot, he's had a hit that somebody has once a year. He's fishing Alan Taylor's Ecton Lakes, and he's had one of them fish that somebody every year has, like a multiple fish hit with a couple of the big ones, and it's him this year. He's still in mid session now. I think it's his last day today, but I know he had three yesterday morning and two the day before, so he's made up. He's had one of the big ones, one of the 40s at upper 30. And he's chuffed, because it's a tricky old lake, those Ecton Lakes. I do hope Alan's invited me down to go and fish them at some point on a guest session, which I'll do this autumn, because Alan Taylor is a super entertaining guy. He's got lots of history. Used to be Kevin Maddox's fishing partner abroad for many, many years, and I spoke to him about coming on the show, and he's a real character. So I don't know if I'm going to go down and interview him live, or whether I'll just do it over Skype. But Alan will be on at some point, and he's what an entertaining chap he is. His lake's at Ecton, me throwing up fin pretty much everywhere I've seen. It seems to have kicked in after the summer lull. It's all good. I can't wait to get fishing. I'm probably not going to be fishing for a couple of weeks. I'll tell you what I've decided, Mark. After a conversation with a few people, as you'll hear in Mike Wilmot's interview, he's almost finished doing his book at the minute. Now, I know you and I have spoke about books many times over the years, and I'd kind of shelved the idea. Books are not as popular as they once were. I mean, there used to be a real money spinner, you know, pre-internet days. If you wanted any carpy knowledge, it was through a book. I've actually just stacked all my carp books up on a new unit we've got under the stairs, and I've just put them all up there. I found my leather edition Strictly Carp by Martin Clark, which I decided to put up for sale, because Martin told me that they are the last one that went up for sale was a few years ago. They hardly ever come up because they're very rare. I think there was only 30 made of the leather bounds. And the last one,
numbered.
They're numbered, yeah. I've got number 23 of 30, and signed by Martin Clark. And the last one went for about £600, apparently. I believe the book market isn't quite what it used to be a few years ago. But I looked at it and thought, I mean, it's a collector's item, and I'm not a collector. I don't have any other valuable books. You know, I've got all my Hutchie books, and you know, Kevin Maddox and Carp Fever, and I've, you know, Malin's books. I've got a load of books, but they're just the normal versions. I have no special books, and I'm also not going to go and spend £5,000 building a collection either. But this book is a missing piece of somebody's collection out there. So if you want it, I've put it up on eBay. I'm not expecting to get £600 for it, but it is up for sale. It's pointless me having a collector's book when a collector could have it, because it's not like I've got a collection or it just so happened that one of my close friends was one of Martin's close friends when the book came out, and I bought it off him at the time, like literally. So I've had it since it came out. It was about 2003, which is what, 13 years?
Wow, that long ago.
2003 I think the book was, yeah. Strictly Carp. Martin kindly shared my eBay post as well. Go and check it out if you are a book collector and would like it, or speak to me privately. But Martin kindly shared the post for me, so I asked Martin if he would like to be a guest on the show, and he has said yes as well. So we'll have Martin on very soon.
Oh, brilliant.
In the next few weeks. And yeah, and if you are a book collector, if you are a book collector and want a very rare copy of Martin Clark Strictly Carp, like he said the last one he's seen up for sale was years ago, and they all sold out immediately when he released them. So it is a rare copy. Yeah, slightly discoloured on the front, the pages are immaculate, they're all like gold lined on the outside, and slightly discoloured because of the sun. I think it was near a window at one time. It's gone slightly yellowy on one side. It's like green leather. But yeah, have a look on my Facebook if you are interested in that. But yeah, I'm not going to be fishing till the end of the month. I'm going down for the Nash Tackle Show to have a look at all the stuff, all next year's products. And Kevin said I can fish his lakes while I'm down there, so I'm really looking forward.
Well, I think it would be rude not to.
It would be, yeah. So, yeah, I've got a good few days down there, and hopefully I can go 3 for 3 and catch another one of the 18. That would be delightful.
Are you on the cops or church?
Both. I've got a good few days. I've got a couple of days on church.
How many rods you taking?
I've got a couple of days on church over the weekend, and then from the Monday I can fish on the cops. So I shall be endeavouring to catch some carps. But yeah, so there's loads going on. I'm thinking about an autumn lake as well. I'm not sure where I'm going to fish. Might have a look at the Bluebell Complex for a little autumn campaign. Talking of autumn, we've got a Carpcast Social on Christchurch. Christchurch is on the Lynch Hill Complex in Oxford. We have guest Frank Warwick's going to be with us all weekend. We've got Fired Up Barbecue, Richard coming down to deliver a feast. We'll be having a few beers, and there are at least 20 40 pounders with a couple knocking 50 pound these days on Christchurch. And to get early October for the lake to ourselves privately, I guarantee there's going to be some big fish caught on that trip. It's only 250 quid. Contact Mark or myself, or you can just go straight on our website carpcast.com, and you'll be able to pay a deposit for the trip. You can pay half now and then half a bit nearer the time, but it's only five weeks away or something, and there are a few places
it's
left
not
on
far
that.
Off this.
Yes, yeah,
7th to the 9th of October.
Yep, so if you'd like to fish with the Carpcast favourite, Frank Warwick, listen to what he's got to say, have him help you out with your rigs, bait, all sorts of stuff, and myself, and catch loads of big carps, then this is for you. So please do get in touch if that's something you are interested in. I know I'm already... there's a couple of lads that are becoming regulars on the Carpcast socials. Drew up from Scotland, Sean, who's been top rod on both Carpcast socials so far. Yeah.
Different Seans.
Oh, is it different Sean? Of course it is.
Sure.
Yeah. If your name is Sean, there is a decent chance of you being top rod. If you're called Sean.
Yeah, that's just clicked. Yeah. But yeah, it was Sean, who was on Royston, has booked up for Christchurch, and Keepy Bob's asked me to reserve him a place as well. And if you fancy just getting in touch, and if you want to see what sort of shenanigans go off, go to our Facebook page and just look at the videos, especially the one which has nearly 30,000 views.
Wow.
Of Jamie showing how to land a zig, well, land a fish by a ridiculously long zig with the help of Alan Blair.
Yes, do have a look.
What a video that is.
Yeah, it's a good one. I didn't know it was near 30,000 now.
It's 28.8 or something last time I looked, which is phenomenal. It keeps getting shared and it's viral, I think is the word.
Yes, that's cool. That's cool. Anything on the net, Mark? Have you seen much?
Yeah. Should we have a rant?
Okay, well, Mark's rant is this. Do I need to get a jingle?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of, if you want, but I'm not one for ranting. But one thing that does repeatedly annoy me is the disregard of fish welfare on commercial match fisheries.
Yeah.
Not all of them are well lads. You know, some of them, like, I know Messingham Sands, you know, they're really good with it. But Hayfield Lakes, they've just had the Maver match this final. You know, there's a lot of money involved in that. You know, it's a big money match. I believe it was televised or has at least been recorded for TV. The Lakes got KHV. It still went ahead. I can't quite get my head around that. And let's talk about coincidences. The River Tawn runs around the back of Hayfield Lakes. The River Tawn is my local river. I saw a carp floating dead down there last night. I'm not saying it came from Hayfield, it might have been from the river, but I've never seen a carp in there before. And it was a little ghosty, probably about £5. I'm not saying anything, but make your own conclusions to that one. But I don't know, it's just profit before fish care. And it's not the first time. I remember a picture a while back, there was a fella, he's got a rather large landing net, and these little F1 carp, they call them, you know, between, like, I don't know, £1 and £3. And they were just stacked up in there on top of each other. I feel the poor little fish underneath, the fish must have died. It grinds my gears.
There's you just reminded me, Des Taylor, who is a long time name.
I saw that post as well.
Long time name in the industry. He made a post a couple of weeks ago. Des likes making posts and getting stuck in controversially. He's extremely opinionated, as we are, and when he feels passionately about something, he gets stuck in. Now, he made a post middle of August. Said, I've read about a 6-hour match where a guy caught 1,300 pounds of carp and only came second for the winner, who had 1,500 pounds of carp. He's been ironic. I'm really proud of this sport and where it's going. It clearly doesn't mean that. Let's one moment forget everything about these catches, reflect a little of the quality of life that these fish in such a water that can produce such catches. I feel sick. And somebody actually broke it down. It's got 172 replies in it, so I'm not sure if I'm going to find this very quickly, but they basically took an average size of carp and worked out exactly the frequency that in a 6-hour match that the guy would have had to caught these fish. Let's have a look, see if I can find his post, because it was pretty staggering. When he broke it down, he worked out this guy must have been dragging in an average of whatever pound fish, like, every so many seconds to have caught. It works out as a 4-pound carp every minute for non-stop 6 hours. So that carp, wow, it's getting dragged. So if his average of £4, which they're mainly F1s in these matches, £4 carp every minute, non-stop for 6 hours. I mean, that is a staggering figure. How many fish must there be in there for that? For two people to have done that, first and second. How hungry are those fish on a daily basis? It's overstocking at its finest. I mean, I remember when I was match fishing in the 80s, there weren't F1s and stuff. We were fishing rivers and canals and lakes and stuff. You know, you were catching bream, skimmers, roach, rudd, perch. You know, there's no hybrids in the lakes in those days either, as hides, as they call them now, which are, you know, hybrids specifically stocked on match lakes. But I mean, you were winning matches with £5, £7, £10. You know, being tricky, you know, and them extra couple of fish made a difference. It's now an endurance test. Even some of the carp matches, you know, it's a case of not sleeping for 48 hours sometimes, and, you know, the guy that sleeps the least is the guy that catches the most, because they're fishing overstocked lakes where it's physically about, it's a physical endurance test. And that, to me, the skill should be in the tricking the fish, not in the how quickly can you catch him, how many rigs can you make up before you even get to the event. You know, that's all it's that's how it seems to be going, and I don't like it. I agree with Des on this particular one. I mean, fish welfare, it can't be good to have that many fish in a lake for those sort of volumes of fish to get caught, number one. Number two, where's the fishing skill in it? It's just whoever can physically do it the fastest, and by doing it faster, ripping the fish's head off to get it in seconds, can't be good for the fish. And then, as you said, continuing to have a match on a lake that's got KHV, and somehow this seems to have got into the river, or people have been dumping fish in the river, or I don't know what you're kind of insinuating there, that there's now dead carp floating in the river, but they've either come out of the lake or the KHV has been transferred to the river somehow. I don't think it's a good thing for the sport, do you?
I think it's a disgrace. And I'm going to watch this when it's televised, you know, if it is. But there's another thing to watch out for, which, you know, gets me, is the way they handle them. They'll net them, and they don't play them out and draw them over the net. They just chase them and scoop them up. Like you said, it's all about time. They pull the net back into the lap, they unhook them, and excuse me. You know, they do use barbless hooks. That's the only thing I can say for them. And I've seen some people where they pick the fish up behind their gills and then they just drop it into the net. You know, the fish is like just landing on its tail, going backwards. That can't do them any good. And, well, another point I'll make, one of our greatest defences against the anti-angling brigade is that we look after the environment. We are the guardians of the rivers and the canals and the lakes. How can we say that when we are creating lakes that there's more fish than water in there? The fish welfare is just not even thought of, never mind a priority. And, well, it just leaves us defenceless. You know, we are treating fish like cattle.
Yeah, I agree. We've both had a bit of a rant on this one. It's something I feel passionate about. I mean, I'm not over... You know, at the end of the day, we do catch these carp for fun, you know, and we do stick hooks in their mouth and pull them out of their natural habitat. So, you know, I'm not a prude to what we do, but I think there's accepted norms, and we are very big on fish care. We do have nice mats and, cradles, and, you know, we treat the fish for injuries and stuff before we put them back. And that seems to go out the window on matches. You know, I've never even liked from an early age, you know, them big keep net shots, you know, at matches at the weigh-ins where these fish are just like Billingsgate, You see them on a sea boat, you know, when they've been dragged in to be killed and, you know, in nets, and they're just all tipped into a tray or whatever. It's, I've never really liked seeing that in matches anyway. I don't know. No, I don't like it, but it's money, isn't it? There's big money in this match fishing.
Oh, there's huge money. I think there was 70,000 in that Maver match this down at Hayfield, but there's one sand with us. I mentioned Messingham Sands. I know on the matches there, when they have the weigh-ins, it's two of the employees there. They do all the weighing in, not the anglers. And they're in the water with the chest waders. You know, they are looking after the fish. So they're not all bad, but a lot are, unfortunate. And I do think that they can, get the house in order. If any matchmen are listening, or carpers who do that sort of thing, get in touch. You know, tell us what it's like in these matches. I mean, I live literally 10 minutes walk from Hayfield Lakes. I might have a walk down and see how long it takes me to get kicked off when I start asking the people who run it about it.
Big placard and a banner. Go on, get protesting. Yeah.
Get protesting. Start marching up and down with a carcass sandwich board. Jimmy's
rant! Yeah, I like that little rant. I think we're justified now. I've just remembered what I was saying before we went on the net. I had a point about something I was doing after speaking to Mike Wilmot and being a little bit inspired recently. I'm going to write a book. Yeah, I started talking about this before, didn't I? We've spoken about this
on and off for a long time.
We have for a long time. And what brought it home to me is chatting to Jacko, chatting to Mike Wilmot, you know, two guys that have been around a long, long time. Talking about people like Jack Hilton a lot, who probably wrote the best ever fishing book, A Quest for Carp. These guys were fishing from the 60s and stuff. And the thing is, in the modern age, when they talk about you know, catching 22 pounders, 23 pounders, 24 pounders, which were huge fish for their time. That's the equivalent of 50s now, maybe even the 60. That's the equivalent of. It means nothing to, you know, a young un reading that now. He's like, oh, I've caught hundreds of 20 pound carp, you know, because it's a very common size of fish these days. So it's kind of lost the deal that it was at the time. It's kind of lost. Now, we know there's not much money in books anymore because of the internet, because of media and everything. So it's not a money-making thing like it used to be. You know, there's a lot of... I remember Julian telling me, you know, he bought his first house off what he made off selling books. And it was very lucrative. You know, fishing has been kind to Julian, as he's the first to admit. And that's why he gives his services for nothing, usually, most of the time. You know, he's a fantastic ambassador to the sport. So writing a book is not a monetary gain anymore. You'd be lucky if you break even on it, I think, unless you're a Terry Hearn or a Dave Lane or, you know, somebody right at the top. You know, Mike Wilmot self-publishes his books. He does all the work himself. And it kind of inspired me thinking, if I am ever going to document my fishing, it needs doing soon, because I take the Colmere capture that I had, which was the fish known as the Banana Common, from a super low stock lake. That fish was a scraper 40 pounder, which even in today's carp climate is not a huge fish anymore. I mean, it's still significant, but it's not huge. But I mean, that the time we were joining lakes and traveling 3 or 4 hours drive to fish a lake that had one low 40 pounder in, and this was an unknown fish. Yes, the locals knew about it, and they'd gone to lengths to keep it fairly quiet, but it hadn't been caught. You know, I remember Terry Hearn telling me that those fish, he knew about it and he'd had a look at it. A good friend of his was fishing on there at the time. Shout out to my man Ev, the best cockle picker in the Northwest. So he does, you know, that cockle picking. He put a video up the other day, actually, of how they do it. It was basically waist deep in mud, in chest wade, it's like sea mud. They had all these boats moored up and it looked like an endurance test, just marching about in these waders. I looked at it and thought, blimey, it looks life threatening for a start. It looks like it's not hard to get in trouble in there. It looked like a very dangerous occupation. So shout outs to Ev for grinding that all these years. But his friend Terry Hearn told me, I remember him vividly, him saying to me, those fish are uncatchable. They are in there, but they're uncatchable. You ain't, they're natural feeders. You're not going to catch them. And they would have been caught by now. Some good anglers had a go over the years. They'd have been caught by now, which just, you know, that's a red rag to a bull for somebody like me. I'm gonna try my hardest from that point on. And I did catch these fish, and it's the equivalent of catching an unknown mid 50 now in a lake that's got half a dozen carp in 100 acres. You know, that's the equivalent of that capture, which will be lost in a few years on people when, you know, everybody's catching 40 pounders because every lake's got a few in. It will be a little bit lost, just like maybe Jack Hilton's 20 pounders were in 1968. You know, so I think if I'm going to document it, and he's doing now, it's not a thing to make money. I'll probably publish it as an ebook and maybe do 500 copies for people that like collecting, you know, carp books, because I know there are people out there that do it. But the main thing, I was listening to a podcast, a lot of these sort of life podcasts that I listen to, and it was talking about everybody should write a book. There's nothing to do with fishing, but just generally the process of doing it is a very rewarding one, both personally and you know, the actual thing of doing it. And the age of self-publishing, I downloaded some software that I can make it on my MacBook, and I'm doing it. I actually started, I wrote the first paragraph, and I don't care if it takes 6 months, 12 months, 2 years, 5 years, I'm doing it at some point. So yes, you heard it here. I know I started talking about this before, and then I got sidetracked, as we do in these chats. But yeah, I'm going to.
But, you know, I'm every cast we record now, I'm going to ask for an update.
Yeah,
how many words, how many paragraphs, and that just to keep you on your toes, keep you motivated.
I'm the world's biggest.
I'm sure you'll be.
I'm the world's biggest procrastinator, so I do need it. I've actually bought myself a motivation whiteboard that I'm looking at now. It's up on my wall. It has a load of targets of things, which is one of the reasons why I've been flying on the Carpcast this last week, because I have a to-do list of guests that I need to speak to. I've done half the list, and the other half are people, ignorers, people like Dave Lane, who keeps saying he'll do it and then won't commit whenever we message him. But I'm sure we'll get him on at some point. Rob Malin's exactly the same. Mike Wilmot's on there, who we've done. Lee Jackson's on there. Roger's actually on there as well, who we are going to, which won't be a problem to tie him down. And Alan Taylor's on there. Yes, and Alan Taylor's on there as well. So it's a motivation board. It's already working, and my book is now up on there as one of the things that I'm going to do. So, yeah, I'm hoping. I don't know how much I'm going to get stuck into it. I'm not going to put a time limit on it, as Mike said in his interview later on, that as soon as you put pressure on yourself, it becomes unenjoyable. And I want it to be a rewarding process for me doing it. So. Yes, if anybody's got any titles for said book, then by all means fire them my way. I have no prerequisite for titles, just something that's good. I thought about something like 10 from 10, something like that, because a lot of these people put in the...
Where did you get that idea?
The 10 pictures that are going on Facebook, these stories, Paul Harris... tagged yourself and me, and I was 50-50 as to whether I'm going to do it or not, and then I thought, well, if I am going to go to the trouble of digging the pictures out, and you know, a lot of these stories haven't been told properly, such as the Colmere fish, obviously the Cheshire Big Commons as well, quite a special story. I think if I'm going to tell those stories and go to that trouble, I might as well document it properly. You know, I'm somebody that doesn't do things by half. If I'm going to do it, I'll do it properly or not at all. So I think if I'm going to start digging all the old pictures out and the stories, then I might as well go for it and tell the stories, you know, in detail. So I am going to do it. Yes, keep pushing me every week, because yeah. I do want to do.
You mentioned your motivation board. We've got something similar in the kitchen. At the moment, it says empty dishwasher. And that was left for me by my loving wife. Well, across the top, it says it's the shit to do board. That's what it says across the top.
Yeah, we've got one on the fridge.
Usually writes a list before I go fishing.
We've got one on the fridge, and I think empty dishwasher is on it, and then somebody's written underneath, fuck you. That's how it's. I think it's somebody, one of Rachel's friends that came round, that's actually written that, because it wasn't me, and I bloody hope it wasn't Megan, my daughter. So, so yeah, that's it. I think we spoke about Mike enough now. I think let's get Mike in on proceedings. Feels like I'm in love. Just had So I'd like to welcome a legend of carp fishing, somebody whose first book I really enjoyed, and I'm super looking forward to the second one that's in production. I'd like to welcome Mr. Mike Wilmot to the Carpcast. How are you doing, pal?
Yeah, I'm fine, Jamie. Yeah, fine, thanks, mate. How are you?
Yes, I'm okay. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. I know you've been super busy following your Facebook and the exploits. You've been working really hard, 12 hours a day book writing, I believe.
Yeah, between winding a few people up and, you know, the usual things we do. But, been working hard on that. So, you know, it's been sort of, nearly 5 years in the making now, really. So, been spending a lot of hours on that, but getting to the end now. And hopefully, probably another 2 to 3 weeks and I can let it go. And it's kind of ready for the print, hopefully in sort of early to mid-November, yeah.
So you mentioned winding people up. For those of you that don't know what that was, you had a legend, carp fishing royalty, I would say, in Sir Pete Springate down. Was he at your lake, at your house? Was he this weekend just gone?
Yeah, Pete. I mean, we go back a lot of years, and he tends to come down once every couple of years for a session or two. And he's doing the forewords for the book, and we wanted to tie a few things together. And he came down with his mate Norman Paul and my proofreader Terry Doe to sort of get a few things done. And I suppose that's what you're pertaining to, was it? With the you're going to mention the wind up, yeah?
Yes, yeah. You teased everybody for a good few days that Pete had caught something very special, and when you finally let the tortoise out of the bag, was it?
Yeah.
So what's the story? You actually own them. I've seen these before in pictures. You own two huge tortoises, don't you?
Yeah, well, actually, it's four, although we lost one several months ago, unfortunately. But, it's really my son's kind of little... it's my son's pets and the sister-in-law. You know, they'd got them several years ago now, and big what they call Solcata tortoises, which are huge. Victor, the biggest, is about 37 kilos in weight.
Wow.
It kind of goes back a few years ago. Pete had come down again, and... he wanted a picture for his daughter Kat. He said, "Oh, can I?" You know, I said, "Yes." So he's held the tortoise, and I said, "Well, look, you might as well hold it." I had no intentions of a wind up at this time. I said, "Look, you might as well hold it like you hold a fish, sort of thing, you know, with a lake in the background." And the kind of it really progressed from there, really, because I thought I'd have a bit of a wind up on Facebook and say that Pete's just smashed the Somerset record and put it up there, you know, with a monster. I didn't tell any fibs at all. It was all kind of worded quite well, in as much as Pete has got this monster, and never mentioned fish, so no one could accuse me for lying or anything like that. And of course the phones were red hot. We had Angler's Mail, Angling Times, Carp Talk, everyone was on the phone, and we kept it going for a while. But poor old Pete was sort of inundated with his mobile, as you can imagine, in meltdown. So we kind of eventually put the picture up of him holding the tortoise. It was quite a nice little wind up, really.
It was his iconic brace shot that he's very famous for. It was the double tortoise, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, this time round, we because people were saying, well, how could you have, you can't beat that. And when Pete had agreed to do the forewords for the book, I mentioned to my proofreader, Terry Doe, oh, we'll have to put his brace shot in, Pete's brace shot of the Yovany brace from 78. And it was only, and Terry said, oh, he said, it'd be nice to get a tortoise brace shot. And of course, that sort of got us thinking. And I thought, well, if we can replicate everything in the way that he was holding those fish nearly 4 years ago. So we kind of played it all over again, this week just gone. So yeah, it was quite funny, really. And I put a status up on the Facebook that, this is going to rock the carp world to the core. And it was great. And I mean, everyone saw the funny side of it as well, because you've got to be careful. I've, a few times on Facebook, because I've got quite a dry sense of humor, I'll put stuff up there like, and kind of people take it the wrong way, and you've got to be a bit careful, because so I was hoping that no one took it the wrong way. And yeah, I got loads of messages, calls, and it was great. I think everyone took it in good spirits,
I remember you sort of documented the creation of your lake on Facebook. How many years ago was that now that you made it?
We purchased a lake 17 years ago, 1999. So yeah, we've had it 17 years now.
What have you done to it? Did you just build the house on the side, or did you is the lake as was, sort of thing, from when you
bought
it?
It's a long story about how we come to get it, and that's kind of detailed a little bit more in the book as such on that particular chapter. But to cut a long story short, we purchased it in 99, and there was nothing really much in there. It was a bit of an overgrown, there was carp in there, but nothing of any size up to sort of like high doubles. We took it on and just developed it and worked hard, year after year after year. Kind of always wanted to live next to the lake and get a house, but unfortunately we was outside the village boundary, and you've got to provide a proven local need to actually build a house. And it took me 10 years of fighting the local planning office, to local planning officers to actually get the house built. And 10 years of really, really, hard graft kind of getting past that. And eventually we got there and got permission, and we got a house built about, what, 5 years ago now, and yeah, we live on site overlooking the lake now, and since then, you know, by doing lots of things the right way, you know, the fish have now come on and, you know, up to mid-40s, you know, quite a good in the 30s, so yeah, it's really, really, really turned out well.
What sort of size is the lake?
It's about just under 3 acres.
Wow, that's the dream. The most carp anglers dream, have a beautiful lake, decent fish in it, and get a house on the side of it. I mean, you've kind of won won the carp battle there, or the carp dream, I would say.
Yeah, you know, it sounds a lot easier than what, you know, yeah, living the dream is probably a good analogy, but it's, you know, there's a lot of hard work goes into it. I mean, when we first got the lake, this was well before kind of otters were known, if you like. I mean, I remember years and years and years ago, went to a BCSG sort of fishing, and there was a chap called Fred Sykes that done a talk on, he had a fishery up in Carlisle, up near, on the borders of Scotland, that was having a problem with otters, and I remember thinking, you know, otters, well, surely they don't eat carp, you know, you know, we'd never heard of it, you know, it was unknown of, and I'd walk him around the lake one morning and found a fish sort of pulled up out of the water with his throat taken away, and I'm thinking, well, that's a bit odd, and I've called the EA out. It was back in the days where the EA would come out if you got a problem, and yeah, we found out it was otters, just couldn't believe it really, but so the first thing we'd done was put an otter fence, like a chain link fence, and all the way around the lake. Lucky enough, because it's only about 3 acres, and I was a riparian owner, we could do it. Unfortunately, a lot of fisheries can't do that, and we buried it into the ground, put electric fencing over the top. And yeah, I mean, really, you know, we had to do that before we looked at anything else, because there's no point in stocking carp and bringing them on and creating a real haven for them if they're going to be, you know, ottered, so to speak.
Yeah. You live in the southwest, don't you? You live quite a way down the country.
Yeah, Somerset, yeah.
So, and have you always lived down there? Did your sort of early carp fishing start in that area?
No, I'm a London boy, mate. You may tell that, and you know, sort of born and brought up in London. Moved to Somerset when I was quite young, 11 or 12. Stayed here for a few years. Moved back to London. Used to fish a lot on the Thames, or grew up on the Thames, if you like, fishing for all sorts of species, and eventually to progress into carp. So London's my roots. But you know, I kind of sort of made a life down here now, and a good life, I must say. Got married at a young age and had kids at a relatively young age, and yeah, it's fantastic. You know, when we can all share, you know, my family share that journey that we've come on.
Did you struggle for waters down there, or is it as good as anywhere else? I mean, I used to travel to Devon and stuff in the 80s, because Devon and Cornwall, you could fish all the reservoirs sort of on a day ticket. You used to put money in a box on a lot of them, and you could fish the close season and use 3 rods, which was the key factor back then. You know, everywhere else was shut, like during the Easter holidays and stuff. And we used to travel down there and stay for a week fishing. But apart from the reservoirs, I didn't know what else there was sort of down that way. Is there plenty of water?
Yeah, I mean. Yeah, there's plenty of water. I mean, you know, in terms of it depends what species you're talking. If we're talking primarily carp, you know, there's loads of waters. I mean, Bridgewater area, for example, where I live, there's quite a few clay pits, because there was quite a big industry making sort of brick and clay tiles, you know, back in the sort of 1920s and 30s and so on. And there's quite a few clay pits, but it's not a renowned area for big. Lots of doubles, lots of, you know, a fair few twins, a few and far between. So you've got to travel a distance for anything of any size. So in short, yeah, you know, quite a few waters, and we've got the lovely river systems, you know, what we call the Somerset Levels, with quite a few rivers and sort of man-made relief channels and what have you. So, you know, it's quite interesting, but, you know, obviously these days waters are progressing, and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to create a decent lake and fishery, really, with big fish, because, you know, it lacked that in this area. But unfortunately, being a relatively small lake, you know, I wish I kind of, you know, I can't cater for everyone. We've got a small syndicate, and those guys have sort of worked hard from day one. So, but no, in short, you've got to travel, Jamie. You know, you've got to travel a fair few miles. I've always said you've got to travel, generally speaking, 60 or 70 miles, perhaps to the, you know, Gloucestershire area, you know, to any abundance of what I call, you know, decent-sized carp, really.
And where was the carp bug? At what point in your life did you think carp are the species I really want to catch? And you know, the first sort of serious lake you fished, or the you know, what was the catalyst?
Well, back in them days, I mean, I'm going back now to the early 70s, yeah, I was fishing for all sorts of species. As a youngster, you know, on the match scene, you know, as a 12, 13 year old, and doing all right actually in that, and I enjoyed it, which was the most important thing. But, you know, I started sort of turning to carp at the age of about 14 or 15, just locally, you know, places like Dunware Ponds, which a lot of obviously local guys would be aware of. This is obviously, you know, quite a few years before the hair rig. You know, but don't forget, a carp then of even a double figure carp was quite an achievement. You know, it's hard to believe now, you know, but a fish of 20 pound, you know, was massive in that day and age, you know, so especially even more so for around here. Yeah, that's where I kind of cut my teeth, if you like, carp fishing on a few local clay pits, and then progressing further as the years went on, really.
And you said you used to travel to sort of Gloucestershire or that sort of area. I mean, Ashley Pool was Gloucestershire, wasn't it? Was that towards that way?
Yeah, Cotswold Water Park. You know, fished a lot of years, you know, in Bridgewater and the surrounding area on the clay pits, you know, catching quite a few, and the local river systems, the local drains and Somerset wetlands and what have you. And, yeah, I just reached a stage in the late 80s. Well, I got into the breakthrough really coming when I had a phone call one day from Peter Moen, the late Peter Moen, sadly, who passed away earlier this year. And I got into the BCSG in 1987, and because that opened up a few doors. And, you know, Peter Moen rang me one day and said that there was a place at Ashley Pool. Was I interested? And that was really the first chance I had at really having a crack at some bigger fish, you know. And, you know, I joined Ashley, which I think then was, I think, if I remember rightly, I think it was about £50, I think, the syndicate fee, you know, which was... all those years ago. But, yeah, so Ashley Pool was the first sort of big, what I call big fish water I fished. And, I mean, you know, historic as well, of course, you know. I mean, you know, perhaps, you know, the likes of Redmire and Ashley may be only second behind Redmire historically in this country.
Yeah, for sure. I remember reading stuff about it when I was younger, and one of the main things that stuck in my mind was the cabbages. I mean, I've heard them described. Was it just full of these cabbage things?
Yeah, well, cabbages are basically underwater lilies that haven't come up, but yeah, quite often they would just stay submerged. But yeah, it was lilies covered sort of 80% of the surface, and then if you got past the lilies, you got the cabbages underneath. But right. You know, because of the plantation, the aquatic foliage, the photosynthesis, and what have you, and you know, the water was always gin clear, so it was fantastic. I always used to liken it to almost like a giant aquarium, you know, where you could just watch the fish's habits and watch them come in and their reaction to certain baits and ingredients and rigs, of course, as well, and the reaction to, you know, bumping into lines. And so it was a massive, I mean, apart from the historic side of it, because, I mean, it was just great being at Ashley, you know, the likes of Fish and Swims, like, you know, Hilton's Hide, you know, the likes of, I remember reading sort of Jack Hilton's sort of Quest for Carp, you know, in the younger days, and yeah, Talking about Ashley. So yeah, it had all that historic sort of content about it. But yeah, it was an eye opener in so many facets. Really was a lovely water to fish from that point of view, for sure.
One of the biggest things in fishing, I mean, technology's helped us these days, and from the sort of Corder underwater videos, it was the first insight we really had of what went on under the water. And I guess you had that insight from an early stage, like you say, if you're seeing, you know, how carp approach a bed of bait, or what happens when they swim into a line, and you know, what happens, I guess you could see them picking rigs up and stuff, could you?
Yeah, I mean, God, you know, numerous occasions, you know, virtually every time I fished it, you'd have a kind of up close and personal encounter. And that was the first place, you know, because I've fished waters where, you know, you just sat behind the rods in a particularly in clay pits, in a muddy coloured water and what have you. And yeah, it was the first place that I could actually see that happening properly and watch them communicate. You know, people may sort of find that a little bit sort of odd, you watching fish communicate, but I can guarantee you they do. You know, it was just so uncanny how, you know, fish would come over a certain area and maybe sort of bump into a line and the old pecs would go out and it would move away and it would sort of go over to another group of fish and they wouldn't go to that area. And yeah, you know, really saw some eye-opening things. And I think I covered quite a lot of it in the first book, Carp Life, you know, yeah, regarding, you know, sort of various close encounters I had. And, yeah, it was all interesting stuff, not just in rigs, like I said, in bait as well. And, you know, yeah, there was so much to learn. And really, from my own point of view, it kind of taught me an awful lot about how fish behave, you know, when they bump into line certain areas. And I always used to say, actually, that, you know, your best chance of a bite or your best chance of a fish for sure was in the first, particularly if no one had fished it for a few days or a week, is the first few hours you were there, you'd kind of catch the fish off guard and quite have a bite or a fish quite early. And then once you'd had one, that was it then. It was hard work thereafter because it was almost like, you know, they all knew what was going on from that point onwards.
Yeah, it's really interesting that. I'm going to touch on the bait that you mentioned there shortly, but the communicating thing amongst carp, I've had this conversation on the podcast with Kevin Nash a few times. And, you know, he's strongly believes the carp talk to each other, communicate, however you want to look at it. Without doubt, they convey, you know, signals of danger, maybe signals of food when there's a decent food source there. I'm not sure. But this is stuff that I've learned from 30 odd years fishing. And you kind of saw this in your early days, didn't you? You've seen all this stuff at first hand. And that's got to be such an insight to help you, you know, on every lake you ever go in. You're never sitting blind behind rods because you're picturing what's going on, because you've already seen it, sort of thing. Which,
yeah,
I think I need to read your book. I've not read it since I bought it, which was when it first came out, which was, well, I've got a signed copy from you that I bought, which is 2002, 2003 or something, was it?
2002, yeah, 14 years now, so... yeah, shame on you. You should be reading it every week, Jamie.
I'm definitely going to have a refresher on it, I think, because it's. I think I probably missed the significance of a lot of, you know, your findings on Ashley Poole at the times.
Well, yeah, I mean, to be fair, I mean, you know, I'll be the first to say the book's a little bit outdated now. I mean, it was 14 years ago, and of course, you know, you can only fish with the you know what we have available to us. But it's like anything, you progress with your fishing knowledge every year. I mean, you know, I'd look back now, if I was in that same position now with the knowledge I got, I, you know, would have caught more fish again. Although, you know, I was always quite pleased with what I caught there and how, you know, how I fared on the place. But you know, but yeah, it was an eye-opener, there's no doubt about it, in everything. And most of my bait knowledge, not so much bait knowledge, but certainly a lot of what I found out there in terms of ingredients and ingredient usage and their reaction to certain additives, you know, you could put bait out and, you know, they'd come in and they'd pick a little bit up and move on and you know, come back and have a little bit more. And then, you know, you'd add one or two certain additives, shall I say, and that was the difference between, you know, them clearing up the whole lot, rooting up the lake bed, you know, trying to find out more. And it was only by doing that you could really gain a better understanding of what additives work better than others, what those... I mean, there's no such thing, I've said it a few times, there's no such thing in the bait world as the Holy Grail. It just doesn't exist, because you've got there's so many other facets that come into, so many ponderables that come into it. But, you know, you could certainly, you know, there's a massive difference between, you know, presenting them with a bait that they really like and one that they could pick or choose. And, you know, because, you know, don't forget, it was massively rich in natural food as well. So you were competing against that all the time, as well, you know, so... Yeah, so much can be learned, and I learned a massive amount during my time there about baiting ingredients and certain additives, and I learned that if you get it right, it's the difference between fish throwing caution to the wind, if you like, and once they throw caution to the wind and they really want more, your chances of catching one are going to increase, you know, a hundredfold.
I've always believed that we catch them when they drop their guard, and, you know, however you can get them to drop your guard is the key to, you know, to being a good angler. And whether that's because you're giving them a baiting situation that they can't ignore, or that turns them on, or you're creating competition, or everything else goes out the window. They'll bump the lines out of the way, you know, you'll catch on, you know, not quite so sharp hooks, or they basically hang themselves, I think, once you can get them preoccupied or just, you know, turned on to feeding. And you're saying you can do that with just tweaking certain attractors or ingredients?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you've got to bear so many things in mind. I mean, you know, I wish it was as easy as just sort of putting an extra ingredient in, and all of a sudden they, you know, feeding frenzy, and you can. The problem is, I agree that when they throw caution to the wind, you can catch anything. But most of the time they don't throw caution to the wind, and I'm not talking about Ashley. I'm talking that any lake I've ever fished, I find that most of the time, particularly these days, because a lot of waters are pressured, I think most of the time it's very rare to get them into that mode whereby, you know, they're just throwing caution to the wind. I think that happens on certain weather conditions, you know, certain when angling pressure drops. And I think there's times, but because 90% of the time we're fishing when they're not throwing caution to the wind, I think that's when it sort of gets really difficult. And I think that's when you need to be looking at other aspects. I mean, going back to, you know, I've mentioned in my writings quite a bit in recent times, you know, tactical baiting. There was an incident referred to Ashley Paul where I was fishing across to a snag tree, for example, and you could put as much bait in the tree in a snag as you want, and they would eat it all up, just like on any venue, you know, because they feel safe. But they wouldn't come out the tree to eat the bait, you know, because obviously they didn't render it as being safe.
Yeah.
So I sort of started fishing a method, whereas on the left-hand side of the snag tree, I was just using a single bait on its own, hook bait that is,
yeah.
And obviously there was a bed of bait on the right-hand side of it, and they would come out the snags, hoover up all the bait that was in the snags, but as soon as they come over the bed of bait, they would, you know, pecks would go out, and they would take wide berths of it, and almost looking for lines as they sort of moving their pecks back and forward. And then they'd come round the other side of the tree, and this was the trick, and when I had a hook bait, just a single bait on its own, I was picking up fish, bang, you know, and doing really well and catching fish on that method. And it was just kidology, really. It was just sort of tactical baiting. It was tricking them into a scenario that they, you know, they were so concerned, if you like, their thought process was so channel thought into, you know, giving the wide berth of this big bed of bait to the right of the tree, that when they come around and found a single hook bait on its own, bang, it worked. And I've used that method to good effect on quite a few waters. I've had a lot of people over the years that have read that and said, God, you know what, I've used that same method and it's caught me so many fish. It's just thinking outside the box, if you like, you know.
I'm smiling. Yeah, I like the sound of that one. Or maybe having the bed of bait with no lines over it, so if they do investigate it, they're not finding any danger whatsoever, and fishing no rods on the bed of bait, and, you know, fishing sort of singles off it. I mean, like I said, I don't, carp definitely communicate, and they definitely learn by the mistakes, I think, and I think they convey danger to each other as well, but it is kidology, like you say. It's just a case of doing something different, and that'll have a short lifespan. You know, if you only put a bed of bait out and then put two rods as singles either side of the bed of bait, you know, the two rod lengths away or however far, depending on the size of the lake or the area, there would become time where they realise that feeding on the bed of bait was safer than picking the, you know, the singles up around the outside. So it's just a case of adapting when you notice a drop in, what, catch rates or whatever, I think. So you were... It was very common. I think the last time I rolled my own boilies was in the 80s and 90s, and obviously a lot of decent firms, including your own, came around then. Have you always made your own bait? Was it something, you know, maybe from Ashley Paul where you could see the reaction? And you know, when did, how did you start making bait? Was it just when everybody else was in the sort of 80s and stuff, and you just continued to do it?
No, it was years before that. Yeah, because it was years before that. Because I suppose, you know, being a dinosaur, I am. I've kind of come into carp fishing well before there was any commercial bait companies available.
Yeah.
The first one I remember was Bait 78, you know, and you know, they'd done a little paste bait called High Pro, but this was before the hair rig, so I was fishing sort of, you know, kitty cat paste and stuff like that. So, you know, sort of munchies ground up and, you know, all sorts of like that. So it was just the kind of a natural progression. You know, I can appreciate that if carp anglers come into the sport these days, not just now, but any time over the last probably 30 years, they're in, you know, everything's available. So this is, you know, you kind of, Back in the early mid 70s when I started carp fishing, you know, you had no choice. You either sunk or swam on your ability to put together a bait, and then eventually, sort of, you know, your other ingredients will come along, like your cationation, your caseins, and your some of your Hafe's ingredients like Robin Red. And everyone was trying to keep it a secret. They were using Robin Red, but you're going to their swims and they had bright red hands, you know. And so there was no bait companies available. So my interest in bait was stemmed well before then. And I put together my first bait brochure in 1984. So, that shows how many years I've been doing it, because, you know, I was doing all right on my baits and catching quite a few fish, and some of the local lads sort of wanted some as well. And that's how it progressed, really. I just started making them up for a few friends and friends of friends. And it was mainly separate ingredients then. You know, I was getting the caseins over from Holland, you know, what they call the Dutch DNV casein, and, you know, bringing that in. And you know, it progressed from there. So, no, it was years before I fished Ashley that I was kind of had a big interest in carp baits, but it's just that Ashley took it to another level. That kind of took all my thinking to a stage above, because, you know, I can actually take all what I'd learned in the decade before that to another level. And of course, you know, in the later years of Ashley, that's where I developed the B5, you know, which was based on how they reacted to certain ingredients. And, you know, it was a journey from there, really. So, it was years before that. And as I say, it was about 1980, 81 that the hair rig first started whispering and talking about. And it just changed everyone's fishing completely overnight. So the bait was a progression from then, really, mate. Yeah.
The B5 is the bait you were known for. I've had a lot of friends use that exclusively for a number of years. It seems to work everywhere. I mean, what can you tell us about that bait? I mean, was there a light bulb moment there when you discovered that one? Was it all to do with the, you know, your observations on Ashley? Or, I mean, that, you know, it seems to be a bait that stood the test of time, and there aren't many baits that have done that.
No, that you're right. That, you know, it has without a doubt stood the test of time, and, you know, I'm not going to use this as a platform to emphasise that, because that's not me. But, you know, you've only got to look at the, you know, historically, you know, what that bait has caught over the years, from all your famous, you know, from your Basils and your Heathers on the 8-litre, your Marys on Raysbury, to your Black Mirrors on the Near, and so on. So I'm not going to, but, you know, it was a progression. I mean, before the B5, old school anglers and customers alike, if you like, will remember some of the range I was doing that were based on, used to have what, the fish and liver mix, and the fish and shrimp mix, and eventually the fish extract mix. And so the B5 was a progression from some of them, really. You know, I was using the fish meals, the low temperature fish meals, and sort of, you got like the fish and liver mix obviously had the liver powder in there. The fish and shrimp mix was an interesting one. That was one of my early baits, and that had a pink shrimp meal blended in. And it was quite funny, really, because it was, if you boiled the baits, because it had pink shrimp meal in there, it was specifically, I believe it was the first commercial bait that was ever developed to, you know, for critical buoyancy levels, if you like, because the pink shrimp meal in there was in there at such a level that, because most people were making their own baits, and we never produced the fish and shrimp or the fish and liver ready rolled. It was always in base mix forms. Yeah. And, you know, back in the day, probably 90% of anglers used to roll their own baits. But the fish and shrimp mix, if you boiled it for 1 minute 45 seconds, it would sink. But if you made the mistake of overboiling it for, say, 2 minutes or 2 minutes plus, it would float. And I kind of created a rod for my own back, really, because, you know, now the people that was, you know, sort of saying, no, I bought this mix, but it floats, and they were making the mistake of boiling it too long because, you know, depending on when you count your boiling the time from when it actually starts to boil or when you put it in the saucepan. So, yeah, so that they were the early mixes, and then of course I progressed onto the fish extract, and of course all these were being used at Ashley Paul, and all being, and then of course the big changing point was that I stumbled across a product called which I market now as Fruit Factor 6, which is a formatin based natural protein sweetener. And that was really the trigger, if you like, in the B5 that made a massive difference between that and other fish meal baits. It's a brilliant silt repellent as well. It's a taste modifier, and of course I was using that, and that was the catalyst, if you like, for the B5. And I remember the very first time I ever used a B5 at Ashley, I caught five fish in a 24-hour spell on there. And that had never really been known of before.
Yeah.
It's hard to put that, to convey that in these days. But, I mean, you know, Ashley was a sort of place where I think Alec Welland had 9 fish in a season once. And, you know, it was looked upon as a phenomenal result. And,
yeah,
you know, I'm kind of going up there for basically a day and a night and having 5 fish, and including Humpy, you know, yeah, the famous mirror, which is sadly now gone. Well, like most of them, because mainly due, a lot of them due to otters. That's kind of the B5 story and how it progressed. And then, well, the rest, as I say, is history, mate, from there on, you know.
How often do you ever come across an ingredient where it's startling, something, you know, different happens, or something out of the norm? I mean, is it quite a rare occasion that happens? Like you said, it was some sort of sweetener or just something that's, you like, blimey, we're on something here.
Yeah, it's not, ingredients like that are very few and far between. You know, I could probably count on one hand with a finger missing, you know, the amount of ingredients I've found like that are sort of game-changing, if you like, you know, but particularly now because there's so many bait companies around and so many different ingredients. But, you know, back then there was nowhere near, as you can appreciate, the amount of bait companies around as there is now. So, you know, the amount of ingredients available today is vast, you know, by comparison. Yet, you know, because there's competition around in the bait industry, I don't think the quality of bait is anywhere near as good as what it was back in the day, simply because there's so much competition out there for the bait, so the price becomes key. You know, people have got to, companies have got to sort of, you know, drum that price down, and with that, there's certain sacrifices that sometimes have to be made. So, but in terms of individual ingredients like that, no, they you know, few and far between, I would say, yeah.
We've had a few bait gurus on the show over the last year. Mark Bryant, who you may know, is not too far from your area.
Yeah, no, Mark.
You know, I've also spent many years chatting with Gary Bays. We had John Baker on last week. Frank Warwick's gone sort of deep on his pHs and stuff. And something that occurred to me very recently after talking to, you know, a lot of knowledgeable people is the fact that waters all over the country have completely different makeups. So that, you know, a chalk pit in Essex or an irrigation pond in Kent or Essex is going to be different to a silty mere in Shropshire, or, you know, a Cumbrian natural mere is going to be different to a gravel pit in Cambridgeshire, you know, that's built on a peat bog. I mean, have you found that whether it's pH or the makeup of obviously the substrate that's underneath is obviously colouring the water to a degree, you know, with its minerals, its pH and whatever. It occurred to me that you could actually make the same bait but tweaked for different areas. Have you ever come across like a bait, I mean, you don't have to name one of your baits or anything, but a bait that just didn't work on a type of water, and maybe that was just common to that area? You know, I've been on lakes where people say Nash bait doesn't work on it. You know, I'm like, absolute rubbish. You know, I put a bait in front of a fish and it's probably going to eat it if I get everything else right. But like, do you think that's a thing? Do you think it's regional? do you have to adapt a bait to make sure it works everywhere instead of just hammering one part of the country and not really working elsewhere? Or is that a thing? Well, have I made it up?
I think it's kind of plausible to a degree, but generally speaking, I think that I'm a kind of a bait man, as we've spoke through from the developments over the years, but I still think that everyone seems to look at the bait and blame that, the bait's not working, when you hear a lot of people say, that bait doesn't work here and what have you, but most of the time people always look at the bait, but most of the time it's not. I do think that obviously a good bait makes a huge difference, of course, but at the end of the day I think that it's down to application, and lots of things we've been speaking about just now, really. But if you look at going back to one of the baits you just mentioned, like the B5, I'm not trying to revert it back to my bait, because there's a lot of good baits out there still, but generally speaking, I've never really found anywhere where it doesn't work in that particular water, but it does in that one. And I respect that there's different makeups and different pHs in different lakes, but mainly once a bait's been in the water for a while, it will sort of neutralise to whatever that pH is anyway. So I'm not I've never really specifically developed a bait for one particular water, if that's what you're kind of alluding to. I've never sort of done that, and I don't believe that you need to do that. A good bait seems to be a good bait pretty much wherever it's used, really.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Is that the case? I mean, I used to take lake water when I used to roll my own bait many years ago. I'd take the lake water home from the lake that I was fishing in to boil. Same for, boiling up hemp and stuff for particles. And it was just an obsessive thing. I had no idea if it made any difference. It was just like what I did. It seemed logical. It only occurred to me last week that it was a comment that Kevin Nash had said to me, and when they're field testing a new bait and they're getting it right, and it was tweaking it, just changing things slightly to make sure it works everywhere. That's something that they have to do sometimes with baits or whatever. And I just thought, hang on a minute, there must be so many different substrates if you take the length and breadth of England, because lakes are different.
There is, but once you get that bait, once you get the bait right, once you get the levels right, once you get the nutritional formulation right, the rest of it, should flow. I don't believe it's a case of certainly wouldn't tweak it for each individual waters. I mean, admittedly, you do hear stories that bait won't work here or that bait won't work there. But generally, I mean, I'm fortunate again because living where I am as well with the, I got the fishery and a fish farm. Don't forget, we've talked about the fishery as such. But I we bring on carp, and I've got holding tanks, stock ponds, out ponds. And I do a massive amount of testing on them, and that's such a bonus for us, and generally speaking, that as well, it's kind of almost like bringing Ashley back into my own front room, if you like, with the facilities I've got here to be able to do them tests. So, and that tells me a lot, when I'm testing and when I'm using things. And then of course it's got to go out to the into the lakes and under the pressure of fishing and a fishing situation, which is totally different, I accept, but I've never come across anything whereby, we've developed a bait here, it's working well, turning fish on, it sort of triggers a stimulatory response, but yet on such and such a lake it won't work on there. I've never had that situation, so we are in a fortunate situation that we've got the whole shebang here with how we can sort of test and try products. But interesting what you're saying though about Kevin and the different ways that people, the different methods people use to use the bait and forward it.
I wasn't aware too much about the breeding program you've got. I have seen your Black Mirror babies. You've put pictures of those up, but I didn't realise. Is it a commercial sort of? Do you sell fish? Do you breed fish and sell them?
No, not at all. It's more of a, for the love of it, really. It's more from, I've never really wanted to get too deeply involved. I've got a little, we have Spar Schult College in usually once a year or every other year to net down the main lake and take the fish away. But we've got various ponds. I've just purchased some more land not too far away from here, about 10 acres, which I plan to develop some, another lake is a long-term plan in due course. So a lot of the fish are being grown on from there. But we just love experimenting, particularly my son Lee. Yeah, he loves it, you know, and we just love experimenting with different fish, different sort of genealogies, different backgrounds, you know, certain fish from certain waters that it's difficult for me to talk about, but certain fish that we've brought through, and just love it. And there's no better there's no better satisfaction than bringing a fish on from an egg and then looking at 20-pound, 30-pound and so on, knowing that you brought that fish on. It's just fantastic. That's probably the only thing, you know, within my pastime that gives me more satisfaction than actual fishing. It's just watching the fish grow on to, you know, from an egg or you know, a lot of the fish that we've got in the lake now, we've brought on from sort of 4 to 6 inches long. Yeah. One in particular has just gone over 30 h, which is an absolute stunning fish, a real beautiful looking fish, real sort of deep pink hues, coloration to it. And we brought that fish on and a number of others, you know, from about 4 to 6 inches long. So there's a great deal of satisfaction in that, but it's very, very much a hobby and something which is non-commercial. But you know, we get, apart from the satisfaction out of it, we also get to, you know, catch these fish at a later date when they get big. And as I say, going back to the bait side of it, it's great for our experimental purposes as well.
You alluded to the secret lake, or a lake shrouded in secrecy, but it forms, you know, a few chapters in your first book, and I presume you're going to cover it in your second book, and that's Frampton. I don't want to go too much into the detail of it, but I think it's just interesting that lakes out there that maybe some people aren't aware of that are shrouded in secrecy, and we have the pleasure to find little bits in your books when you do write about them. I mean, it's a place that's obviously very special to you over the years.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was covered in the first book, and then I left, you know, for a number of years, and it's been over the years, publicity has been limited, and rightly so. No one, in fact, we recently put it to the members that what they wanted to see in terms of publicity, and you know, the vast majority didn't want the fish to appear in the weeklies and monthlies, and you know, with catch reports stuck over them, and I can understand that. It was voted that they wanted to see a little bit of publicity in book, archival book material, and so I have covered that in Carp Life 2, quite extensively. I can't say too much on it, as I say, because there are publicity limitations, so I can't really, and I don't want to go into too much detail, over this kind of interview about the ins and outs of Frampton, but suffice to say that, you know, I've covered that in the book with some, I think some fantastic material and some marvellous fish, I think it's inspirational, but I think it's, I feel a kind of duty, if you like, to pass on certain knowledge and about the lake. I think if it's quite selfish to wrap it up and not show any of it to the public eye. I don't think it hurts to show a glimpse from time to time about the jewels, the special jewels it holds. There's some interesting material on that. It's a publicity sensitive shy water, and rightly so. But as I say, it will be covered in the book. See what happens there.
I agree that we deserve a glimpse every now and again of these sort of places. You know, it'd be a shame to keep it completely hidden from the general public, because it's clearly is a special place. I think the only time I can ever remember seeing it in like a carp talk or whatever, was it Baz Griffiths? Did he brace a big uns from there one time? And I'm sure that got carp talk coverage at the time.
Yeah, I mean, Baz had had some good fish over the years, and don't get me wrong, it did quite a number of fish went into carp talk over the years. But, you know, obviously the explosion as carp fishing got more and more anglers coming into it, I think the publicity has got stricter on there as the years have gone on. And, you know, I can understand that and I can see why. And I'm all for it, you know, don't get me wrong. As we all know, I run a bait company, and there's plenty of phantom fish get caught sort of month in, month out from there that would be great for me in terms of, you know, putting in the weekies. But I would rather not go in there. And, you know, a few years ago, a number of them did. But no, I think, you know, a glimpse of this historic and enigmatic fishery, State Lake, from time to time is good. You know, I think we all grew up reading material from the likes of, God, you know, if you're going to go back old school in my day, you know, your Jackie Orton's I mentioned Quest for Carp earlier, or your Dick Walker's, or later years, Rod Atchison, Kevin Maddox, and so on. I think, you know, we all had to learn from reading that material, and I think it's a little bit selfish now if we was to say in years to come, oh, by the way, you know, I'm not going to divulge what's happening here. So I feel personally that, yeah, I think it's a good thing, and as long as it's not gone over the top and it's just now and again, I think it's fine.
I think it's great to have that mystery in fishing. I mean, I remember reading some of the early books around there. I mean, I read the Jack Hilton book. That's why I first sort of heard of Ashley. But I think having that magic, that little secrecy, the people go fishing for different reasons. Some people just want to catch fish. Some people fish commercials, day ticket lakes. Some people want to go and hunt out the unknown ones. And you know, some people do a mix of all of them at different points in their lifetime. But having... I recommended your first book actually to somebody the other day. They sent us a message on the Carpcast basically asking, you know, they've just finished Terry Hearn's first book, that they loved the you know, the Mere chapters, and you know, that finding something, could I recommend another book that's got some of that in? And I remember from your first book, it was probably one of the first times I'd actually heard about the very public lake that's in there, the water park. I don't know if you want me to name it or not. And then
Coldwater Park.
Yeah, it's the first time I'd ever read it about that, although it's probably known about, you know, to the people that fish there. And then you found another place, the chapter after it in the book was a sort of an unfished place. I don't know if it was a reserve or whatever, but you did a bit of the sneaking around type fishing as well, didn't you, afterwards? And those chapters in books, they're magical for me. You know, that's the sort of fishing that I've always done over the years. You know, I've loved finding something that, even if other people do know about it, you know, it's that kind of, it's that magic and mystery of fishing that really attracts me to it.
Definitely. It's you know, like we mentioned my early days, you know, back in the 70s, you know, a few times in this call, and that was a great thing about them days. We never knew the ceiling for any waters. The fish never really had names. I mean, no one knew the ceiling. I mean, for all we knew, fishing even back in the Dunware days near where I live now, you know, there was always that sort of, oh, you know, I mean, don't forget, you know, a fish of 30 pounds in them days would have been the equivalent of like a 60. You know, it was incredible. Yeah. So, you know, we was always of that belief that, oh, you know, there could be a few 30s, maybe even a 40-pound fish. You know, it was the mystique and the mystery of the enigma was unbelievable. And I love that side of thing. And, I mean, that's why, you know, you mentioned the, you know, not so much Coldwater Park, you know, because that was slowly starting to get known. But there was the, yeah, there was the reserve side of it that was, you know, secret water, as I called it, that was sneaking around. And that's great, because you, there was always that buzz and anticipation. And, of course, you know, then, and you don't need to tell you, the obviously Colmere, you know, the one down in near Raysbury, the Mere, as it's called, you know, I'm covering that, and the Quest for the Black Mirror in Carp Life 2. And their waters, you know, have just got such mystery to them, and, you know, the mythical common, and, you know, and a lot of, I'm glad to say that a lot of the mysteries will never really be solved, and I like that, because once they're solved, they're not mysteries anymore, are they? So you lose that sense of mystery and enigma. So yeah, I'm like you, mate. I'm I love all that side of things, you know.
It's good, like I say, it's an extra attraction to the already sort of enjoyable bits of fishing, and that's why even the, you know, the well-known lakes like the Framptons and stuff, it's nice for some of them to have mystery as well as you know, the unknown lakes. It's good that there is still you know, some of that about. And what was the going to the Mere, for those that don't know, it was home of one of the most iconic fish ever in the country, which is the Black Mirror. There was another common that I've spoke to many people that believe they've seen it. Was it found dead? I mean, that lake had a fish kill. Was it ever found, that fish?
No, I believe it was never found dead. I mean, there was reports that it was seen dead, but never actually physically found dead. It all happened a bit quick, really, because I mean, obviously it was after I'd caught the Black Mirror and I'd pulled off, and it was two or three years after. You know, I'd had a call from John Mack, that is John McAllister, yeah, to say that you know, the near fish were all turning up, and it was like, wow, you know, I wanted to drive down there and then, and it was on a Sunday afternoon, and I was watching football on the box, a big Chelsea fan, as you probably know, and I'd had a few beers, and I thought, you know, I can't go down there, so I went down there the next morning, and again, I've covered more of this in the book, exactly what happened, but. I believe that, yeah, as I say, I believe that, you know, a big common was seen dead but not found. So, which is great in a way. I mean, the EA had gone down there, and whether they'd removed some fish, that could have been possibly, that they could have removed the fish, but probably unlikely, because I met a girl down there the following morning. I got down there nice and sharp the next day at first light to, you know, see it all from my own eyes, and met a girl from the EA, and we went round and I helped her carry some of the equipment while she'd done some DO tests, and we certainly never found, by then the Black Mirror had been disposed of, if you like, and that's what I like, though. I'm so glad it was never found, you know, and you know, we don't even know if it existed. I mean, that's the crazy thing, you know, there were sightings, but that's the great thing about it, is the mystery side of it, you know, and the mystery of where the Black Mirror came from. You know, I go into that in Carp Life 2, and I've got my own theories on that after, you know, speaking deeply to quite a few people I know that used to fish it back in the, before the Black Mirror was ever caught. And, you know, I've got some stories again in the book that, you know, of one or two, you know, unbelievable fish that were seen in there that were never ever caught. And this was when the Black Mirror was in its, you know, about 27, 28 pounds. So it's got lots of mysteries, that water, that are gladly, I'm happy to say, are lost in the mist of time, and we'll never know the answer.
I think it's kind of fitting that these fish weren't found either. I think that's just kind of rounds it off nicely, leaving the mystery unsolved. I think it's quite good.
Yeah definitely. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable. I mean, you know, I bumped into a chap, like, I won't go into too much detail because it'll spoil it, but I bumped into a chap called Kevin at Pete's 70th earlier, the latter part of last year in December, and who used to fish the Mere, and used to do a lot of scuba diving in there as well. And just in some of the stories he was telling me of what he'd seen in there, as I say, I won't spoil it for anyone, but, like, you know, it just kind of opened my eyes up. I learned a lot in a conversation at the bar with him, for about him and his wife, over a conversation that lasted about an hour. I just learned so much about what was in there, and, you know, he was a proper nice genuine guy as well about everything, and those mysteries are gone forever, and long may the mysteries live on, eh?
Do you think we'll find a new Colmere? Do you think they're out there? Do you think we have to go abroad for it? What's the future hold?
Well, I think there's plenty abroad, put it that way. I mean, I've found a few and you know, sort of written about them as well, and there's plenty abroad. I think in this country, I think there's still one or two. But I think as time goes on, carp fishing becomes more popular. We're always searching for that final frontier. I think you know, in terms of lakes, probably the chances are getting slimmer and slimmer each year because everyone wants to find another near. I can think of one or two that I know about in my mind that exist. You know, definitely. But I think also we've got to look at the river systems as well. If we're talking about the final frontier, I think that, you know, there's so much sort of to explore still even in the likes of the Thames, River Thames, for example, you know, and such like. So, and I think it's great, and I think we've got to keep those mysteries alive, and we've got to keep believing, and yeah, for sure, I still think that there's, you know, I still think they exist, you know, there's hope that, let's hope they still always remain mysteries, if you like.
And we've been chatting an hour. I did say this would probably fly pretty quickly. Looking to wrap it up, I'm sure we can get you back when the book's out and we can go into a bit more detail about certain stuff. But generally, what does the future hold for you? Where do you see yourself going? See yourself doing some fishing abroad? Have you got your eye on a few places?
Where I see myself going over the next week or two is to the local hospital, because my daughter to give birth, and I'm going to become a granddad for the first time. So at the moment, the family life is all on tenterhooks because Kelly's due any day now. So I'm trying to wrap up the book and get the last sort of couple of chapters finished. I've got sort of 2 or 3 weeks left, and that will be done. And so in terms of short-term plans, obviously, you know, there's a lot of things happening here in the Wilmot family, I know that that's going to blow me away emotionally. I know that that's going to completely blow us all away. So I got that. In terms of fishing, as I mentioned earlier, I've got a nice little project going on where I've just recently purchased nearly 10 acres of land just up the road, literally several hundred yards away from where we are now. So I'd like to develop that. Fishing wise, I must admit I've kind of lost a lot of impetus in fishing abroad. I'm not saying I'll never go abroad again, but it's, you know, I probably will, and I've got some good friends over there, and maybe you know, certainly the Czech Republic is somewhere I've got some good friends. I've been a few times and I'm looking forward to going out there again, maybe Germany. So because, you know, back in the day, you know, when I sort of first set foot on, and we haven't even covered this, on the first days on the first of the English, if you like, to set foot on Lac de l'Orient and Lac de Dour and places like that, it was just magical. But I've never really wanted to go back there because it's changed so much, really. But I'm just glad that I had them magical moments on there during those days. In this country, I'm not too sure, Jamie, you know, what the future holds, really. I'm not too sure where the fish is going to take me. It's changed so much. And I'm a little bit, I just want to get to the other side of this project, after the other side of this book, and kind of get my life back and regroup and see where I go from there, really. But I think what is inspiring me more at the moment is my kind of fish rearing project and the fishery project, more so than the actual fishing, really. So let's see what happens over the next couple of years, really, mate.
Well, I'm looking forward to the book coming out. We've left a bit of a cliffhanger there, because I really do want to talk to you about the Orient and Lac du Dour. Maybe we can save that for next time, if you'd be good enough to come back. When is the book out? When do you think we're going to see that released?
Well, I'm hoping the first book in 2002 was November the 5th, so because we made a play on the remember the 5th of November, yeah, sort of thing. So ideally it would be the 5th of November. If we're running a little bit behind because of a certain baby that comes along, and things are put on hold for a week or two, but let's just say November. Hopefully the 5th of November, we'll be doing some, we'll be putting it on the website soon to pre-order prior to then, for the month prior to it, hopefully. All going well. It's a massive book. It's best part of 200 pages, bigger than the first Carp Life. It's getting on for 500 pages, and so sort of quite excited about it. But at the same time, quite laid back about it in other aspects. You know, I'm not in the public eye anywhere near as much these days as I used to be. So, and that suits me fine. So yeah, it'll be available. We've been making it available through the Essential Baits website, and yeah, fingers crossed, early November release.
That's essentialbaits.co.uk. For those of you who haven't been there before, you can get all Mike's stuff there. You still got a few copies of Carp Life One left, I believe, maybe a couple.
Yes, there is, but they're kind of really not many now, to be honest. I mean, we did consider. I know what's going to happen when number two comes out. There's going to be a surge because I've done a massive bait chapter in Carp Life 2, as I did in Carp Life 1, but I've tried to cover most of the things I never covered in the first book. So, you know, it was intimated by my printers that we could, possibly do a reprint of one. But don't forget, Carp Life 1 has already had, I mean, we sold out of that, and then we had a reprint, so it's already had a reprint. So it's unlikely that we will be doing one of that. But there are some copies left, but, you know, you're talking, you're not many. I doubt there'll be any left by the time Carp Life 2 comes out, or if there is, not many, you know.
Yeah, cool. Well, Carp Life 1 is a fantastic book. I will be pre-ordering my signed copy of Carp Life 2 as soon as it's released. I'd like to say thank you for your time, and hopefully you'll come back and we'll fill in the gaps and talk about the second book.
Yeah, that's right, Jamie. You're welcome, and I sort of wish all your listeners all the very best for the coming autumn and winter ahead. And yeah, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Sorry, I've been a bit aloof and elusive to try and track down, but I try to kind of keep up my berth of all that these days. So yeah, all the best to everyone, and thanks for the call, Jamie.
So a big thank you to Mike. Mike's going to be on the next batch of Carpcast Extras, not this coming batch, but the batch afterwards. He didn't want to spoil some of his fantastic chapters in the book, so that's why he's not in this batch, but he's in the next lot. He's had some fantastic fish over the years. He's a top angler, and obviously Essential Baits has always been quality, as you've heard. I'll tell you something I've seen on the net this week, Mark.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Our old friend Jim Shelley. He's moved bait company to some friends of ours, Sean Leverett and John Max, Proper Carp Baits. You got an opinion on that?
It's not about like me plugging this bait, right? Yeah, it was more to do with I'm trying to show people, right? Yeah.
Well, in other more important news, I put a fresh pair of socks on this morning. That happens about as regularly as Jim Shelley changing bait companies. And I know he'd left Urban. You know, he definitely sells a lot of bait, but he seems to be in a pattern. He'll be with a bait company for so long, then he will leave. He will slag them off. And then another bait will be the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think it does it's itself. All any company is any good.
I think it's a brave move from John and Sean. I do think it's a brave move. Sean's always got on with Jim. I've known that for a long time. Sean's got no problem with Jim. As John Mack, you know, they've always got on. They've never had any malice. You know, John gets on with everybody as well. So and. I can understand the frustration. I mean, I'm sure John and Sean's bait is really good, but there's a hell of a lot of bait companies out there, and I can understand it. It's hard to really push themselves, and it must be frustrating if you've got a really good bait company and you're finding it hard to get where you feel you deserve to be. And I've no doubt Jim Shelley can take that. I mean, who did the Sticky Baits before Jim Shelley? They're one of the biggest bait companies in the country now. And Jim Shelley definitely...
I did, because I know the fellow who started them.
Yeah, but Jim Shelley definitely had a part in that, didn't he? And obviously they threw the money at it as well. Their marketing's great, you know. They've obviously got some good products, and but you know that get on the sticky, you know, that was all Jim Shelley. So, if obviously we've discussed Jim Shelley a number of times on this show, my personal feelings towards him have been fairly well documented over the years. I don't think the guy's a great human being, but that's my opinion. Looking at it from the outside point of view, I'm sure John and Sean can manage Jim as a person because they are friends with him, have been for a long time. And it's probably going to really elevate their bait company, I think. I think it really is, looking from the outside point of view. So, you know, I wish John all the best. You know, John's a personal friend and a top guy. And if he believes he can manage Shelley, and it's no doubt it's going to raise the profile of the bait company. There's no doubt about it. I mean, they'll probably spend 70% of their week making Jim Shelley's personal bait because he's known to use a lot of bait. Obviously sells a lot. It's probably a good thing for them. You know, they're not going into it. They're not just a new two-bit company that are like, oh, let's get a big name and let's try and help ourselves, because they're not daft. They know Jim. They know everything about him. And it's not like they're ever going to get stung by him. So I wish them all the best. I've no doubt that Jim will help rocket their sales and put them on the map. So I don't know what type of deal they've struck between them, but it's interesting watching. Obviously, you know, I'm opinionated and I've got my personal issues with Shelley, but I'm also a pretty logical human being, you know, and can look at things from everybody's point of view. You know, I'm not narrow-minded. You know, I can see why certain people think certain things about any situation. I can see both sides of a story. So, objectively looking at it, it's probably a good thing for John. Jim's got his followers. He's got a huge amount of people that have always followed him from, you know, the different bait companies. But it's just interesting to watch the thread. Obviously, when the Proper Carp Baits made the public post, you know, a lot of the posts were getting deleted straight away. People, you obviously had all the haters come on, and you saw Jim's supporters, you know, and it was fairly balanced between the two. Excuse me, a lot of the haters were getting deleted instantly. But I think, you know, grabbing the popcorn, sitting back and watching was reasonably entertaining. And I think John, who's been doing the Facebook post, I think he's answered it all pretty well. I mean, he's not a mug, he knows what he's doing. And I do wish him all the best, because I think it's definitely going to help put him on the map. Yeah, that's about as much as I've got to say on it. You got anything to add?
Okay. Not really. All the best for John and Sean and whatever, really. Should we move on?
You seemed uninterested to talk about it, so yeah, let's move on.
Yeah, I've got to be honest, I'm not really, not just Stephen with you, I couldn't really care less who goes with what company. I don't know if it's just me, but it's not football in the transfer market, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. And
I'm just old. And
Okay. Talking about bait, somebody who's supported us since the start is DNA Baits. You can find their website, dnabaits.com, and you can buy all their stuff off there, all their post-free deals. They do some fantastic baits. I know a lot of my friends rave about the S7, the Secret 7. The Switch is the newest one, which everybody also raves about. And you can get discounts off all their products using the code CARPCAST5 at the checkout for an extra 5% discount off they're already cheap prices. They do pop-up deals, fluoro pop-up, post-free package deals. They do their fluoro candy sticks, which look ace, their fluoro wafters, all in post-free deals. They do boilie deals. There are two options, like a 5-key deal. You get your choice of boilie and a pot of hook baits for £45 delivered direct to your door. Option two is with the hook baits, the boilies, and a litre of your choice of liquid. They do some fantastic liquids, which you can hear all about in the Mark Holmes episodes of the Carp Cast. He's very big on liquids and had an amazing season on the lake where he caught the 60 pounders from and other big fish. That was all using the DNA liquids, the Hydro Wheat and the Beta Stim, amongst others. Mark creates esters and does all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff. So go back into our archives and have a listen to the Mark Holmes episodes. They even do a 50 kilo deal. If you're looking to stock up for the autumn, you get 50 kilos of freezer baits. You can have it split into two different sizes if you wish. You get the matching cork dust wafters, cork dust pop-ups, and a litre of Hydro Wheat or Beta Stim. And it's only £320 delivered to your door. Go to dnabates.com, use the code CARPCAST5 when you check out, and you can get an extra discount off those already cheap prices. I believe we've got a listener's question, haven't we, Mark?
Ask us a question.
We have. It comes from Jake Maximilian Mulitron, which I'm sure is his real name.
Okay.
He says he's been using a KD rig for most of his fishing this year, fishing it with wafter, and have been having a lot of success. But I've noticed recently a good percentage of them have been hooked in the scissors rather than the bottom lip. My hook to land ratio has been pretty good, around 90-95%, but it's something that's bothering me, and I'd like to understand why. Normally a fairly short hook link, around 5-6 inches, a size 6 curve shank hook with a dumbbell or 80mm wafter. I didn't think about this one, because my first reaction is landing 90-95% of your fish, no matter you know, as long as they're hooked in the mouth, I don't think there's much of a problem there at all.
I don't think there's a problem. I mean, when you hook them in the scissors, it's just how the fish are feeding. Like, it's the angle that the fish moves away from your rig once you've pricked it or once it's sucked the bait in. You know, some, depending on the spot, some fish are going to lift their head up to move around. If they're moving side to side, you're going to hook them in the scissors. I mean, we hook fish when the fish moves away. That's the majority of time we hook the fish. And if you're landing them, they're in the scissors. I mean, I don't. There isn't an issue. That's just how, it's the type of rig you're using, how the fish are moving off once hooked or once they've sucked it in.
I wouldn't go around making any wholesale changes, maybe alter the length of your hook link, you know, even down to, you know, 3 or 4 inches, or, you know, 10 or 12. You know, that might make a difference to where it's hooked, but I wouldn't really be making many changes. It sounds like you're having a good season, landing 90% of your fish, so crack on, keep landing them.
I don't see it as a problem at all. You know, I don't think, oh, I've hooked that one in the scissors. I never think that, you know. To be honest, fish I've hooked, they're always, you know, they're 50-50 in the middle of the bottom lip or in the scissors or somewhere in between. I mean, I would say it's probably fairly even. I don't think there's a problem. Not at all.
If you're getting hook pulls, then I would be changing stuff, but no, just make sure your hooks are sharp, you know, your rig is presenting the bait, which it sounds like you're doing. Keep going.
Certainly,
I've done that one justice. It's an easy question.
Yeah, there was a question that came into our Carpcast page. I answered it, but I did say to the chap that I was going to do this one on the podcast. So I'm just getting it up as we speak. If you think I'm stalling. It was
ask us a question.
Nigel Woodcock. He's had an issue. It was a post that was made. I think some fish have been posted on a catch report on a carp fishing forum, carp.com, I think it was. He moderates this forum, and there's a bloke basically saying that it's selfish to sleep whilst fishing, and we should only have lines in the water while we're awake. What are our thoughts? Before we go into detail, have you got any opinion on that? Is it safe to fish when we're asleep?
Well, my first thoughts would be, with people posting rubbish like that, is don't feed the troll.
Yeah, I think it's a subject that can possibly be addressed. I mean, I can see from a non-angler's point of view, or quite often it's match anglers and stuff that have this opinion, because I've actually come across this in the past. If you remember, there is a fishing club, I'm not going to say the name, because this club has had a no publicity ban, but let's suffice to say one of the biggest clubs in the country. For a number of years, the club was generally run by... it was a match angling club, but they own all the decent water, including all the carp waters, and they've had a few kind of anti-carp angler rules over the years. Many years when I was a member as a kid, they wouldn't allow gas stoves or any type of stove, which basically meant you couldn't cook. So, again, it was to limit long-stay anglers. They've had boilie bans on certain lakes over the years. I mean, carp fishing's evolved. I think they now understand that, you know, majority of their membership is made up by carp anglers, and it's the biggest form of fishing, and they own all the decent carp waters. So I think they've softened a little bit. But for a few years, they did enforce a no sleeping rule. and had bailiffs come round in the middle of the night to check if you were asleep, and if you were asleep you were getting banned. So I have come across this issue before. I don't believe that is the case now, but I've also seen anglers that shouldn't have their rods out when they're sleeping, because I've been on lakes, and I'm sure you have too, where I've heard a screamer and this is ripping, and you know, maybe the angler's been drunk, or maybe they're just a heavy sleeper. But I have heard, you know, I've seen situations where people have had to go and wake the guy up and shake them. I've also tried to wake people up myself in the middle of the night when I've had a fish, and I can't wake them. You know, if you sleep that heavy, and I'm sure you know, if you're that much of a heavy sleeper, and I'm sure the people that this applies to already know this because they've had situations at home and stuff where the missus can't wake them up, or you know, they don't wake up with the phone ringing, or they don't wake up with their alarm going off. Some people just naturally sleep very deep and heavy, and if you do, you probably shouldn't be carp fishing at night. Because if you know you're not going to wake up, if your buzzer rips, then you probably shouldn't be fishing at night. You know, you should be reeling in. I'm sure you've come across people like that, Mark.
Yeah, I do remember trying to wake someone up to do a picture for me once, and they woke up, said they'd be round, and went straight back to bed. Do you remember that one?
Yes, I do remember it very well. That was one of the occasions where I'd caught the target fish. I'd had a fish of a lifetime, the twin from Melstone 2, and we drank cases of beer, sent people back to the shop for more cases of beer, and got really, really drunk as a celebration when we finally crashed. And you had another fish in the middle of the night, and you rattled me, woke me up. I had a stinking hangover, my head was pounding, and I had no intention of coming to take a picture of your fish. I mumbled something to you to get you out of my swim and then fell asleep. But as it happens in that situation, like, I started dreaming, and it came into my dream that you were waiting for me. So I was like, oh, I'm gonna have to get up, aren't I? But I've had people pretend to be asleep. I've had people pretend to be asleep when I woke them up. You know, when you catch in and they just don't want to come and do a picture. Maybe they've got the ump because you keep catching and they're not, or maybe they're just really tired. But I've had it where people have pretended to be asleep, and I know full well they're not. That's a different... We're diversifying? We're going off topic. I think if you're a normal sleeper, you know, our alarms, our technology is good. I've been on lakes where I've heard a screamer and I'm lay there, it's woke me up, and I'm lay there thinking, go on then, hit it, you know, and it's still going. But if you're not snag fishing, you're fishing in open water, just because an alarm's going ripping, you know, going wee, the fish is actually moving slower than walking pace. You know, I've watched fish tear off, and it's never a tear off. Like, you know, at most they go 10 yards. If you're fishing up against snags and stuff, you need to be on that rod. We've all done snag fishing. You know, I've done it where I can pick the rod up from my bed, you know, and I've fished like the reeds peg on Elstow one. You would not even leave your swim for the call of nature. You have to do everything. You have to have the butts of your rods touching your nose virtually in that peg, otherwise you're just going to get cut off. And the second you get a single bleep, you're picking that rod up, and you're not giving the fish an inch. You know, you're bullying it the first rod length off the margin. Now, if you're fishing a situation like that, you can't fish them pegs if you're a deep sleeper. You're just going to lose every single bite. At night, you might as well just reel in at night and only fish the hours you're awake. But that should be down to the angler. You know, people should get the benefit of the doubt. You should be able to fish until it proves otherwise, and if you keep losing fish because, you know, you're snag fishing and you're not on your rods, or you're not getting to it quick enough, or you're not waking up quick enough, then there's just no point fishing, is there? But to ban a rule based on you know, to make a rule banning certain actions based on you know, maybe one person or a minority, I don't think is the case. And our technology is so good that we are just going to wake up the majority of the time, so I don't see it being a problem. And anyone arguing that we shouldn't be allowed to sleep with the technology that we've got, I think is just a little bit bitter or anti-carp. But I can see the argument for people that don't know any different. Oh, can you fish when you're asleep? It's got to be bad. The fish can get into a snag or go away. But unless you're snag fishing, I don't know. You got anything to elaborate on?
No, not really. Can't really add more. But like you say, you mentioned the technology. You know, I'd say a lot of us nowadays have our sounder boxes. We can have a buzzers turned, you know, volumed off or real low, and a sounder box is next to his ear hole. And, you know, we know how it happens. We all get in tune, and you could be nodding off at home. If a buzzer sounds, you're jumping off your sofa. You know, you get so in tune with it, and you're right on it. So, but no, I can't really add much to what you've already said there. It's I think it's a daft rule.
It's a daft rule, yes. I think you should tell us about Carp Talk, Mark, and then we'll call it a day for this one.
Yeah, we can do. Just a scrolling down. The digital version that's $1.49 is available from pocketmags.com on a Saturday. That's for your Apple, Android and PC devices. And the print version, which is out on Tuesday, is $1.99 if you like something solid in your hands.
Okay, that's what she said. What's in this week's? I'm very pleased to see all our Carpcast listeners winning the competitions.
Yeah, we should get a monopoly on that.
Yes, we should. You can get it every week. It's the Bible of weekly carp catches and news, and there's some decent articles in there every week. But I know this week there's some bumper catches. We talked to Adam Walker, who's landed Home Fence Captain Jack at £64. Now, those fish are Israelis, as we know, so that fish is getting big very quickly. It's going to, at some point, if it gets close to the British record, there's going to be some discussion about an imported Israeli fish becoming the British record, whether it still counts. Obviously, they discuss it in this week. Also in the news, Adam Matthews' capture of the wood carving common at 58.2 from Kevin Nash's Cops Lake. A fish I would dearly love to catch when I go there at the end of the month, and who knows, it might be £60 by then. The unstoppable Dan Taylor bags his 7th UK 50 with a mirror from a Kemp pit. Briggs's has a feature in there. He's talking about his recent trip to Poland. Jerry Heaps returns to the mag for the first time in ages as he tackles a water that once held the Irish record. Terry Edmonds is forced to work hard for his oat on his new syndicate water. And this week's weekly competition, Mark, do you want to tell us what it is?
Yes, you can win some of the new Solar P1 buzz bars. And yeah, if it's solar, it's going to be good. They've been doing stainless and bankware for years.
I say it every week, but our Carpcast listeners should be winning these prizes. Surprisingly few people take the time to, you know, get an envelope, do the old school, fill in the competition entry out, and buying a stamp and posting it. And so few people do it, the odds of you winning are very high. And especially if all of our Carpcast listeners do it, then we've got a decent rate for winning these competitions already. One of our listeners won one of those deeper smart cast thingies, the underwater mappers. One of those the other week, one I would dearly like, and I wish I had entered that competition myself. But yeah, make sure you do get this week's Carp Talk from your local news agent. Go and ask them. There's a list of stockists on the Carp Talk website, and also you can get a digital version to your phone, iPad, Android device, PC, MacBook, whatever you have, from pocketmags.com, and it's a bit cheaper there as well. So that's it for this week, Mark. We hope you've enjoyed it. We're back next week with Lee Jackson as our special guest. It was a fantastic interview from him. And it's goodbye from me.
And I'm going fishing.
Yep. Keep your eyes out for some on-the-bank stuff. Something to add as well. I've started releasing the early Carpcast content on YouTube. I know a lot of foreign anglers only use YouTube as their medium for their carpy goodness. So I uploaded episode 1, which was Kevin Nash. Maybe check them out. There's a few pictures. It's a very laborious job uploading a 3-hour podcast to YouTube. It took 24 hours to render the file, and then it took 4 hours to upload the file to YouTube. And I've got the fastest internet speed money can buy. I've got like 80 meg upload speed, something crazy. It's big, 80 meg I think upload, 200 download, and it still took 4 hours to upload it. So I don't know how technical I'm going to get with pictures, but it's just a little bit of something to look at while you're listening to the podcast. And if you fancy going back to number one and listening through some of our archives, then you can do that on YouTube with something visual to look at the same time. So it's just search Carpcast on YouTube. There is a Carpcast YouTube page. Please subscribe to it. There's about 300 subscribers on there already, which I don't know where they came from, because we've never really put much up there. But we will be releasing on YouTube from now. I'm going to try and get at least one a week up there, hopefully two. So that's it from us. Check out our website and support the Carpcast Extra, and we'll see you next week with Jacko.
Yep, see you next week. Can I go now?
Get yourself off. Go on. Go and catch one.
Website at thecarpcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.